Hello and welcome to Talking History. My name is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University, and I'll be your host for today's program. Looking back, as we do every show, at this week, January 12th through the 18th in history, we recall that on January 13th, 1966, the first African-American cabinet member, Robert C. Weaver, was appointed Secretary of Housing and Urban Development by President Lyndon Johnson. On January 14, 1742, Edmund Halley spotted what came to be known as Halley's Comet. On January 15, 1559, Queen Elizabeth I was crowned as Britain's monarch. Her reign would transform England into the most powerful nation of its time. And on January 16, 1920, the ill-fated 18th Amendment endorsing prohibition began to be enforced. It was repealed 3 years later with the 21st Amendment. We have four items for our weekly History in the News segment, all of which grow out of recently declassified or discovered documents relating to former President John Kennedy. First, a recently discovered letter written on August 5, 1957 appears to support a historian's claim that he wrote major portions of John Kennedy's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Profiles in Courage. Jules Davids, a professor in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, wrote the letter to the Reverend Brian McGrath, former university vice president, amidst speculation over the actual authorship of the book that began almost immediately upon its publication. In the letter, Davids claimed to have written five chapters of the book, for which he was paid $700. Theodore Sorensen, a longtime Kennedy confidant, has characterized Davids' claims as an overstatement. Davids died in 1996. In our second item, a newly declassified document offers support to the theory that the CIA offered Chicago crime boss Sam Giancana and his top lieutenant, John Rosselli, $150,000 to assassinate Fidel Castro in the early 1960s. Confirmation has come to light in a May 1962 memo prepared by then-CIA Director of Security, Sheffield Edwards, summarizing details of the underworld contract for then-Attorney General Robert Kennedy. Giancana and Rosselli refused payment for the attempted assassination, but they accepted $11,000 to cover their expenses. Recently released audio tapes from the Kennedy presidential years lend support to those who have argued that Kennedy actions during the Cuban Missile Crisis may have prevented World War III. The evidence lies in recordings made in the Oval Office during those fateful 13 days in October 1962, just after Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev was caught shipping nuclear missiles to Cuba. For 20 years after the crisis, the common view was that the U.S. forced the Soviet Union to back down purely through a show of strength. Then in 1982, a few of Kennedy's aides revealed that he had made a secret deal, pledging to remove U.S. missiles from Turkey if Khrushchev took his missiles out of Cuba. What these advisors did not reveal, but the tapes show, is that the decision to negotiate was Kennedy's. As the crisis reached its climax, it seems all of Kennedy's top advisors, civilian and military, urged him to bomb the missile sites and invade Cuba. Kennedy held firm in his search for a diplomatic way out of the crisis, however, and he was the first to suggest that the trading of missiles might give Khrushchev a face-saving way by which to end the crisis. And finally, the release of a previously classified document will no doubt add to the historical controversy over whether President John Kennedy planned to end American military involvement in Vietnam if reelected in 1964. That document, dated October 4, 1963, only 7 weeks before Kennedy was assassinated, suggests that American military leaders were anticipating a withdrawal of U.S. forces from South Vietnam by the end of 1965. The memo, signed by Army General Maxwell Taylor, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and directed to the uniformed leaders of the four military services, read in part, we're quoting now, "All planning will be directed toward preparing Republic of Vietnam forces for the withdrawal of all U.S. special assistance units and personnel by the end of the calendar year 1965. At the time the memo was written, the U.S. had about 16,000 advisors in South Vietnam, but within 5 years that number would swell to over 500,000. We'll be right back. For the major segment of our show today, we're pleased to welcome back Robert Hopkins, a member of Creighton's Department of History, and his guest, H.R. McMaster, author of the book, Dereliction of Duty.
Thank you, Brian. Next week marks the 30th anniversary of the 1968 Tet Offensive, a surprise communist attack that many consider to be the turning point in the war in Southeast Asia. If ever there was doubt prior to 1968 about America's involvement in the war, Tet changed that, as most Americans realized that Lyndon Johnson and Robert McNamara had misled the country into believing that the war was winnable. But Johnson's deceit went back to the early 1960s as he maneuvered America into a war that he did not want, nor was in American interests. He was ill-prepared to deal with the complexities of Southeast Asia, and when it became apparent that some form of American military involvement might be necessary, Johnson ignored his senior military advisors and turned instead to his inner circle of civilian whiz kids. The results divided America in a way not seen since the Civil War. With us today to explain how and why America became embroiled in the quagmire of Vietnam is H.R. McMaster, author of the new book, Dereliction of Duty, published by HarperCollins. Major McMaster holds a Ph.D. in history from North Carolina, has taught at West Point, and serves in the United States Army. Welcome, Major McMaster.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your title of your book is Dereliction of Duty. Who was derelict? Who are we talking about here?
Well, dereliction of duty, the dictionary definition of dereliction of duty, is an abdication of responsibility. And in this case, in the decisions that led to an American war in Vietnam, the president, Lyndon Johnson, his Secretary of Defense, and LBJ's principal civilian and military advisors did, in fact, abdicate their responsibility to the American people. McNamara, for example, says that in his memoir that we were wrong, terribly wrong, but exonerates all from responsibility. And what a large body of new evidence shows is that not only was the war in Vietnam not inevitable, but that it was only made possible by the deliberate lies and deceptions aimed at the American public and the Congress.
So Vietnam didn't necessarily have to happen. It was not, as McNamara implied, the inevitable consequence of Cold War ideology.
No, that's not true at all. I think what this new evidence shows conclusively now is that it was only because of these lies and deceptions aimed at the American public that LBJ and McNamara were able to maneuver and manipulate the country into this bitter war.
Now, these lies or these deceptions, were they intentional for the purposes of getting America into the war, or did they have some motive related to the individuals?
No, that's what's sort of ironic and paradoxical about this, is that Lyndon Johnson did not want to go to war, far from it. And every step that he took in that direction, he took basically because he wanted to avoid a tough choice between war and disengagement in Vietnam. What this new evidence does show, though, is that Johnson knew as early as May of 1964, months before the Gulf of Tonkin incident in which the reprisals after which the United States made the first bombing runs against North Vietnam, and over a year before the war was fully Americanized with the first large introduction of ground troops into Vietnam, Johnson knew that he had to make this tough choice between war and disengagement in Vietnam. And what's astonishing is that these were men who not only should have known better, but who did know better and did it anyway. Johnson was afraid that making that tough choice between war and disengagement would alienate key constituencies on which his overwhelming domestic political goals depended.
So in short, you were saying that this is really linked, what, to Great Society as well as re-election?
Right, exactly. It's linked to his election in 1964 and passage of the Great Society legislation in 1965.
And that's particularly ironic because Johnson portrayed himself, especially vis-a-vis Barry Goldwater in the 64 election, Johnson was the peace candidate when in fact he was planning all along for escalation of the war.
That's exactly correct. And he was making decisions in this period that are going to lead to an Americanization of the war, first with what was called a systematic bombing campaign against North Vietnam, and then later with the introductions of first a few Marines, and then large combat units into Vietnam in 1965. These plans are underway in 1964, but anxious to draw a stark contrast between himself and Barry Goldwater, he casts himself as a peace candidate and says, "I'm not going to send American boys to do what Vietnamese boys ought to be doing for themselves."
So when you say that he's making these decisions, you're implying not only that Johnson is making the decisions, but his advisors like McNamara, Dean Rusk, George Ball, and others, they're concurring with him, or are they simply responding to him?
No, they're concurring with him, and they're assisting him in pursuing this middle ground, this middle course. What he wants to do in 1964, in the election year, is to emphasize that he's going to keep his commitments in Vietnam. And what he wants to do is to prevent criticism from those who support a continued American and expanded American involvement in Vietnam. He wants to placate, essentially, people on both sides of the issues. And, of course, in August of 1964, with the Gulf of Tonkin incident, in which North Vietnamese patrol boats attack American destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin, and an alleged second incident that happens 2 days later, Johnson sees an opportunity, really, here to stage sort of a political coup against his opponent in the November election, Barry Goldwater, by showing restraint initially and then demonstrating resolve and strength in foreign policy by ordering reprisals against North Vietnam in the form of bombing raids against North Vietnamese port facilities.
Well, of course, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was almost unanimous within the Congress. Is there any suggestion in your research that Johnson was aware that he was so badly manipulating the Congress, which handed him carte blanche enough to establish his own military role in the region?
Oh, yes, it's very clear from the evidence. Members of his own party, Senator Edwin Morse and others in the Senate, know that there are questions about the nature of American planned and supported raids against North Vietnam that provoke the initial attack in the Gulf of Tonkin, and they also know that there are questions about whether or not the second attack actually occurred. But Senator Mansfield, who will later become a critic of the American war in Vietnam, says to his colleagues who are about to ask the really tough questions during the hearings for the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, "Don't you know it's an election year?" he tells them. "You're going to kill the president. We haven't even had the convention yet." The convention was to follow in the next couple of weeks.
So in short, what you've emphasized thus far is the political dimension, the day-to-day politics of the war, the bureaucratic side. One of the key people who are missing here, of course, are the senior military advisors. If war is inevitable, where are those leaders?
Right. Well, what happens is that Johnson, because he's pursuing expediency in the short term and essentially abdicating leadership in favor of this pursuit of consensus, wants from the Joint Chiefs of Staff not necessarily military advice, but what he wants instead is acquiescence for decisions already made and the tacit approval of those decisions, and also what he wants is the legitimacy lent his policy by their uniforms.
So in short, people like Robert McNamara, who had limited real-world military experience in Johnson, although he was in the Navy, certainly one may question whether or not his military decorations reflected actual roles in combat. He needed these military advisors, the Earl Wheelers, the Maxwell Taylors, to provide that legitimacy then?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. And because McNamara is crafting for the president a strategy based primarily not on international political considerations, not on the political and military situation in Southeast Asia, but instead on his short-term domestic political fortunes, he's particularly vulnerable to a disgruntled officer who may raise objections to that policy, either under direct questioning from the legislature or perhaps even a public statement. So he's very upset and concerned about that. And so he takes a number of measures to keep the chiefs really ineffective as an advisory body by taking what McNamara describes to Johnson on the phone as a divide-and-conquer approach to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And then also what he does is he tries to placate the chiefs and hold forth the promise of less restricted military action in the future to keep them on the team. In fact, he calls the chiefs his team and refers to himself as their coach.
Well, that certainly makes sense because McNamara was not necessarily well received by many of the senior military personnel. What exactly did the chiefs really want? If they could have had their choices, irrespective of political considerations, what were the chiefs recommending in Southeast Asia?
Well, this is one of the problems. The chiefs do not have a unified view, or do they really provide a strategic alternative to McNamara's approach of graduated pressure, the incremental increase in the use of force that, that McNamara advocated, a strategy consistent with the president's domestic concerns. The chiefs are hopelessly divided down service lines, and their service parochialism and their inability to transcend narrow service interests really undercuts their ability to influence the policy process as well.
So there was no unified position. The chiefs each had different goals, but were they by and large pro-war? We have this perception of people like Kurt LeMay who used the idea of just indiscriminate bombing, when in fact your evidence shows perhaps that LeMay said either do something or get out completely. There's that real contrast there.
That's exactly right. And the chiefs urged the president as early as January of 1964 to make this clear choice between what they believe will become a large-scale war in Vietnam and a negotiated withdrawal or another alternative to war. Both Wallace Greene, who is the Commandant of the Marine Corps, and Harold K. Johnson, the Chief of Staff of the Army, believe that it will take at least 5 years and 500,000 troops just to stabilize the situation in South Vietnam. They believe that measures are necessary to impose a military and political solution on South Vietnam that's consistent with American interests, to take actions that the president and McNamara are never going to be willing to take. And what is striking about this period in which this war becomes an American war is that if the president and his senior military advisors had ever attempted to reconcile their competing positions here, they could not have helped but come to the conclusion that an American war in Vietnam would have been a futile effort.
Well, in that case, if the JCS or the military advisors were aware that either you should do nothing or you should make a decisive, overwhelming military operation, and neither of those choices were certainly appealing to Johnson in terms of domestic political considerations, was, in fact, the JCS derelict, as you say? What choices could they have had to convince either Johnson or McNamara, or were they in a real catch-22?
Right. Well, you know, the military are not charged with making policy, obviously, in a democracy, and nor should they. But what their responsibilities are to give their best military advice, both to the president and the Congress. What the chiefs do in this period is essentially they advocate their responsibilities under law as the principal military advisors to the president, the National Security Council, and the Secretary of Defense, instead of highlighting what they know to be the long-term costs and consequences of the war, instead of pointing out the fundamental flaws in McNamara's strategy of graduated pressure, they decide, based on the momentum that is built up behind McNamara's approach to the war, to take what, in essence, is a foot-in-the-door approach. Just get the first bombing runs off. Just get the first Marine battalions deployed to Vietnam. And then what they hope to do is, once it becomes an American war, to lobby for a relaxation of restrictions on the use of force, and ultimately to be able to pursue a strategy in Vietnam more in keeping with their ideas about how force ought to be employed.
Well, what you're saying here, for example, is that the old adage that perhaps war is too important to be entrusted to the generals applies in the other direction as well, and that is that war planning or policymaking is equally too important to be entrusted to politicians. How does this affect our notion of even war making or war policy planning in a democracy like the United States?
Right. Well, what is absolutely essential, I think, is a frank, open, and honest civil-military relationship at the highest levels of government, both between the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the President, and also between the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Congress. And the chiefs have a difficult role here, and what they have to do is provide their best military advice and to lay out what they believe to be the potential costs and consequences of the use of military force, but at the same time not cross the line between advice and advocacy of one policy over another, such that they become players in executive-legislative relationships.
Well, you're a Gulf War veteran. Do you feel as if, from your experience there, both as a participant and as a critical observer, do you think that Colin Powell and the other Joint Chiefs were able to learn from this? Is that what happened, or is there still room for improvement?
Well, I think that there are certainly many differences between the situation that Lyndon Johnson and his advisors confronted in Vietnam and the situation that President Bush and his advisors confronted in the Gulf War. But I think what we can take from an examination of those two cases is how military strategy was matched to a clear policy goal in connection with the Gulf War. I mean, what you would think would happen in the national security policy-making process is that the president and his advisors would establish a clearly defined goal for the use of military force. And then what his military advisors would do would be to develop a military strategy to contribute to the achievement of that goal, and then based on that strategy, determine the level of force necessary to carry out that strategy. In Vietnam, the exact opposite happened. The president kept the political goal deliberately ambiguous because he felt that it gave him more flexibility in the domestic and international political realms. In other words, if things didn't work out in Vietnam and he and his advisors are almost defeatist at the outset, they could claim, well, that really wasn't our goal at all from the beginning.
Well, Major McMaster, it's been a pleasure to chat with you today, and from what we've learned from your book, I think we'll all have a great opportunity to reconsider our understanding of Vietnam. Again, we've been chatting with Major H.R. McMaster, author of Dereliction of Duty. Few Americans have not been touched in some way by the war in Vietnam. Fathers who didn't come home, brothers who did but lived shattered lives, sisters whose service has been overlooked for so long, combat heroes who answered the call but were spat upon as traitors to those at home who manned the barricades, burned their draft cards, and fled to Canada or Sweden. For years, these vivid perceptions have colored our historical studies of Vietnam and sustained a contentious and largely biased body of academic opinion about the war. These highly polarized views do little to get us closer to answering our questions about the war and what it means for our past and our future. Perhaps it is best left to a new generation of scholars like McMaster, men and women who were not in the thick of battle either at Khe Sanh or Kent State, to tell us what really happened.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, watch that sound. Everybody look what's going down.
Earlier, Robert Hopkins made reference to the 30th anniversary of the 1968 Tet Offensive, which we mark at the end of January. To conclude today's program, Robert has his commentary on the significance of that event. Robert?
During the January 1968 ceasefire, in honor of the Vietnamese New Year, Viet Cong and North Vietnamese regular forces launched perhaps the most massive communist military offensive of the war, attacking the capital of Saigon and capturing major cities such as Hue. Within 2 weeks, however, these communist advances were reversed as U.S. and South Vietnamese forces reclaimed lost cities and inflicted heavy losses on communist forces. Viet Cong and North Vietnamese casualties included 40,000 dead, one-fifth of their total manpower, and a loss of one-third of their total effective strength. American and South Vietnamese forces suffered 3,400 dead. What began as a significant communist victory quickly became a decisive communist defeat. Except in the United States. The Tet Offensive crippled the already waning popular support for the war. Fed a steady diet of American victories, the American people were just as astonished by Tet as CBS News anchorman Walter Cronkite when he announced on nationwide television, "What the hell's going on here?" he said in his familiar cadence. "I thought we were winning this war." Tet quickly became a symbol of the failure of the American military in Southeast Asia. Its legacy was even more symbolic, as Americans soon learned of U.S. military atrocities at My Lai in retaliation for Tet, and saw their president wash his hands of Vietnam and refuse to run for re-election. In the ensuing 30 years since Tet, scholars have argued about its meaning in a broader context. To some, Tet exposed the limits of U.S. military power, reaffirming their belief that it was not only morally wrong to prosecute the war, but that it was militarily impossible to win the war from the beginning. To other scholars, Tet showed the futility of trying to fight a war with political restrictions imposed by bureaucrats with no understanding of military priorities, capabilities, and objectives. Neither of these two camps holds a monopoly on prescience, however, as there is more than a little truth in both viewpoints. The greatest legacy of Tet and its most important lesson for policymakers and the public today is that the use of military force to achieve purely political objectives is largely bankrupt to begin with. Soldiers, ships, and airplanes can capture an island beachhead, can free a country of an invading force, and can attack targets halfway around the world with pinpoint accuracy. High-tech weapons can increase enemy losses, can shoot down enemy airplanes by the dozen, and can stop eco-warfare by the precision destruction of oil pumps disgorging crude into the Gulf of Arabia. But these are examples of military victories, much like the U.S. military victory during Tet, and they did not or cannot necessarily achieve a political victory. The 1986 American raid on Libyan terrorist training camps did not stop terrorism, nor remove from power those leaders whose states supported terrorism. The 1992 American military mission in Somalia failed to resolve the violent civil strife there, nor did the 1994 American military presence in Haiti bring democracy and economic prosperity to that troubled island. In Iraq, Saddam Hussein remains in power today, a thorn in the side of American, if not Western, foreign policy, despite a truly impressive American military victory there 7 years ago. As we reflect upon those 30 years since Tet, we must realize and appreciate that the limits of American military power were not inherent inadequacies in American military forces. On the contrary, in that sense, Tet was indeed a military victory. The limits of Tet, and arguably a number of conflicts in the ensuing years, are the limits of trying to use military force to resolve purely political conflicts. As long as we fail to make this distinction and continue to believe that the political failure of Tet reflected a military failure in Southeast Asia, then we risk repeating that scenario in other parts of the world. Moreover, we continue to alienate those Americans who have risked, or in far too many cases given, their lives in battle but are judged as failures because their military successes have not brought the desired political goals, a task impossible from the outset.
Thank you, Robert. And with that, we'd reach the end of another Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show, and that if you have any comments, you'll send them along to us either by email at talkinghistory, all one word, at creighton.edu, or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, this is Brian LeBeau for Talking History.